also Vitaly for the second time giving a good introduction to a talk I had to give. So actually I'm going to talk about some sort of generalizations of the theorem of Charcot and Furstenberg that was spoken about in the last talk. So let me actually state it in the finite setting. So this is the theorem of Charcot and Furstenberg. In the finite setting, and actually let me sort of state it in the negative. So if we have a subset of the first n integers, so I'll use this notation for an interval of integers, such that there actually does not exist any d, such that d squared is in the different set of A. Right? So if that's the case, then the density of our set, the size of A over N, must be going to zero. Right? This is actually equivalent to the formulation that we saw in the last talk. Of course, stated this way, it's natural to ask for a more quantitative version of this. How exactly is this density going to zero? So Furstenberg's proof, as we saw last time, is ergodic in nature, and we don't attain any quantitative bounds. But Charcot did obtain some bounds. He actually showed that the density, the size of A over N, is actually big O of 1 over log N to the 1/3 minus epsilon for all epsilon positive. So I'll use these epsilons from time to time in this talk. I'm just suppressing the existence of some log N, some power in the numerator here. So this is telling you that if you have a subset of the first n integers whose density is bigger than some constant times this thing here, then it necessarily exists two points whose common difference, whose difference is a perfect square. So of course, I mean, sort of one tends to think sometimes these days about primes, and so these primes would have density 1 over log n. So if one could increase this number here to be above 1, then you'd see that the primes, the different set of the primes necessarily would contain squares, just for density reasons alone. And actually, I will actually give the sort of Fourier analytic, a variant of the Fourier analytic proof of Charcot, and actually obtain this with a 1 minus epsilon. We'll see that later in the talk, so we'll almost densitize the primes. However, one actually knows much better than this. The actual world record here is due to Tin, Steiger, and Zemaredi. And they actually showed that the density can be O of 1 over log N to some power Cn, where the Cn is actually growing to infinity with N. Actually, it's some log N, I think. So, that's a very, very, very powerful result. So what extensions do we have of these results? So, Vitaly already mentioned in the last talk that, in fact, Charcot proved more than just the existence of squares. He actually showed that one could have, say, any polynomial with integer coefficients, provided, well, let's just say that it has no constant term. Right? But what bounds did he actually get? I was actually looking at this last night, and it's not really terribly clear, but I think he got 1 over log n to some power. He didn't actually explicitly write it down. But what about this world record we've got here? Well, one does not actually have that for any polynomial, but one can get it for any monomial. Any power of D. So what I'd like to talk about today is some generalizations of this where one actually gets a better bound than Charcot, as I stated there, for any polynomial like this, and there's some hope that then we can actually get bounds of the type of pinch diagrams that are ready for these, for more general polynomials, not just for monomials. So what do I want to talk about? So let me just first fix a family of linearly independent polynomials. So let P1 up to PL be a family of linearly independent polys. And let's again just insist that they all have zero constant term. So we'll see why the linear dependence is actually important for us. And let me also just set some notation. Let me set K to be the maximum degree of these polynomials Pj. So of course, because of the linear dependence here, K is actually must be greater than or equal to L. So what's our result? So this is joint work with Akos Magyar. So our result is the following. So let's imagine we have some subset of the first n integers with the property that there does not exist, again I'll state it in the negative, there does not exist a D such that P1 of D all the way up to PL of D are all simultaneously in the different set of A. So if this configuration does not appear in a different set of A, then we can conclude that the size of the density must be O of 1 over log n to the 1 over L times K minus 1, and again with a minus epsilon. Right, so sort of comparing this to Sharkazy, the case with L equals 1, and then you see with L equal to 1, we just get the power being 1 over K minus 1, so in the case of quadratics, then this gives you 1 over log n to the 1 minus epsilon, almost the density of the primes. And this actually is, to the best of my knowledge, actually, for the case of just a single polynomial, this actually constitutes the best bounds which are known. And actually, this was actually previously known in the case L equals 1, just a year or two ago, as was proved by Jason Lussier. I also probably should say that of course, in a sort of in a qualitative sense, this result is already follows. Essentially, I guess, from the work of from the polynomial Zemmereddy theorem of Bergelson and Liebman, because that theorem just says that to forget the linear independence, one obtains a configuration of this type simultaneously in not a different set, but just in some translate of A. But there's no quantitative version of that theorem apart from in the exact opposite of what I'm looking at when these are all actually linear. The Zemmereddy theorem, and the other case where there's quantitative bounds is just this case L equals 1, which is Sharkazy. So our proof is actually, I think, quite a lot simpler than that of Lussier, although he proves slightly more, but we won't go into that. And there's nothing too terribly hard going on here, but I hope you'll agree that this sort of argument is very elegant. So what do we do? Our idea is to just lift this problem up into higher dimensions. So we deduce theorem 1 from another theorem, which one can think of as being a higher dimensional analog. Of Sharkazy's theorem. So all we do is, in order not to confuse myself, let me use B for our set living in 1n to the k. So if we have a set like this, which again does not have any intersection with such that the monomial curve here does not, does not exist the D, it's just monomial curve N of 6. The different set of B, then we can actually conclude something about the density of B in 1n cross 1n k times. We can say that this is O of 1 over log n, and this would just be k minus 1 minus. So in other words, we're actually deducing our result from this one, and I'll show you how the proof of this one goes. And this is in higher dimensions, and it really is sort of a monomial curve. So this is why we have some hope that one can perhaps extend the idea of these sort of formidable techniques of Pintz, Staiger, and Zemeredi into this set. So there's... If you just have... Then we can still get it. Where k is, because if we had that, then we could just lift it up into this setting. They're going higher. As long as k was the degree. I mean, it wouldn't be if it was k polynomials here. Think of it as being L in infinite polynomials here. Then you would get the same bound with a k, where k was the highest degree of those polynomials, because you would just lift it up into the setting further. We'll see. So let me indicate how you get theorem 1 from theorem 2. So this is the idea of lifting it up into higher dimensions. So let me sort of do this just before I sort of indicate how we do it in general. Let's just do it in a few examples. So we're thinking of A being a subset of the first n integers. So let's choose my favorite collection of L in independent polynomials, just the monomials. Right? If you just had these being the monomials, then how do we conclude that this configuration exists in a different set from theorem 2? Well, I need to construct a set B from my set A. Right? So do the natural thing. I just take B to be A cross A cross A, L times. So I'll use the notation, this is A to the L. And that, of course, is just sitting in 1n to the L, so we can apply theorem 2 to this, and theorem 2 tells us when there exists a non-zero D, such that a different set of B intersects this monomial curve, but in each coordinate, these are just the sets of A. So the fact that the different set of B intersects this means that D intersects A, the different set of A, D squared does, and so forth. So that's easy. What about if we had, let's just now take L equal to 1 and just think of a quadratic polynomial. So what if I wanted to try and use theorem 2 to show when this will appear for some D in a different set of A? Well, what might you try and do? So I've got to come up with a B. So what would be a simple-minded approach? A simple-minded thing to do would just be to define B to be all of the elements in, I don't know, 1n squared. I'm trying to go up into two dimensions, such that C1, B1 plus C2, B2 is an A. Maybe you would try something like this. Well, this is doomed to failure, right? I mean, apart from anything else, if C1 and C2 are really large, then this is just going to be empty. Right? And also, so in order to get around that, I suppose we could think of B being in the interval from 1 to n prime, where n prime is some large multiple of n, so that we're by large multiple, this depends, of course, on these coefficients C1 and C2. Of course, we could also have C1 and C2 being negative, so I guess we have to make this go from negative n prime to n prime, right? Then now there's maybe some chance. However, there's still a problem here, right? Because if you think of this as being called a script P of B, right? Well, what happens if you, what is this, if you, what is script P of D2? Right? This is just going to give me all the multiples of the GCD of C1 and C2. Right? So therefore, if A, we could easily pick an A which just avoids all of this. Right? However, if we just translate this around, we will eventually hit a decent portion of A. Right? So it is true that there exists some M such that the size of this image intersected with A minus M should be a decent proportion of the size of A. In fact, the C should be 1 over the GCD of C1 and C2. Right? So in other words, if I allow a shift here, then we actually will be lifting to something. Right? So provided we use this M in my definition of B, it follows then that the size of B will be greater than this small constant times A, and then we'll also have an N because there's some multiplicity going on here. Right? But of course this is just telling us that B over N squared is bigger than some constant times A over N. It's relating the two densities. So from this we now see how we can deduce theorem one for this particular polynomial from theorem two. Because let's imagine that there actually exists a D such that DD squared is actually in the different set of my B. Well, what does that mean? That just means that there exists two elements, B and B prime and B, such that D is equal to the difference of the first coordinates and D squared is equal to the difference of the second coordinates. Right? But then, if you just multiply this by C1 and multiply this by C2, you see that PD is actually contained in, and then this will have C1B1 plus C2B2, which is exactly how we defined our set B. These had to be an A minus M. So this is an A minus M minus A minus M, which is, of course, just the different set of A. So we can conclude the existence of these polynomial differences from theorem 2. And now I think you get the idea what we have to do in general. In general, we just have to put together these two ideas. In general, you want to know when does there exist the D? Not equal to zero, such that P1 of D all the way up to PL of D is actually in the different set of A cross with itself at L times. Right? And of course this is just, one could define this to be some matrix applied to D up to D to the K. And then we just define, we just need to define a set B, so we can apply theorem 2 to it. We just define B to be the analog of what we have up there, just to be the set of elements in negative n prime to the k, such that this mapping applied to B is actually an AL minus M. Right? But here is why it's very important that our polynomials are linearly independent, because that ensures that this matrix has full rank, which is what we need to ensure that we're not lifting up to nothing. So we need this as full rank. So that's how we obtain theorem 1 from theorem 2. So how do I prove theorem 2? Let's see if I can sketch this. So the idea is, As with all proofs of results of this type, is to obtain a dichotomy between randomness and structure. So let's see if I can sketch the proof of theorem 2, and I'll limit myself to the case when k is equal to 2, just so that I don't apply lots of dot dot dots everywhere. The proof is no harder. Everything is contained in this case, really. So let's see how I'm going to do this. So what I have, I've got this grid of integers that's n by n, right? But I'm looking at the curve dd squared, and just so that things sort of fit nicer, I'd just like to divide this up into root n rectangles, just so that this sort of fits my curve a little bit better, right? It's not a big deal, and of course, one can assume that B is actually the relative density of B on at least one of these must be at least as big as it was to begin with in its old universe from n to n. So let me just define QM to be a rectangle with those dimensions where M is the square root of N. So what is this dichotomy proposition? So the dichotomy proposition is the following. So let's imagine we've got a B living in this rectangle here, QM, and let me define delta to be the density, so B over the size of QM. So then provided that M is large, so let's just say bigger than some power of delta to the negative 1, then one of the two things must occur. So first thing is that it could behave as though it were a random set. So let's just say here that means that there actually exists a D such that D squared a different set of B. In fact, one could sort of strengthen this and just say that it has as many as you'd expect a random set to have. But let's just say it has one. A random set should have an intersection like this. And if this doesn't happen, then the set B must be structured. Right? There must exist some grid with dimensions Q, Q squared on which B has larger relative density than it does to begin with. So it has increased density on some structured set. So let me state that more explicitly. So there actually exists some grid, G, in the following form, where L is actually in QL, and L, QL, say, is bigger than, I don't know, something like this. So in other words, and then on such a grid, B actually has increased density. So the size of the intersection of B with G is bigger than delta times 1 plus sigma of G. I guess I need this grid to actually live in my cube. Okay, and then what sigma am I talking about here? And I can do this with sigma equals to delta to the, say, 1 plus epsilon. Right? So this is saying that if B does not behave as a random set, if it does not intersect this monomial curve, then there exists some large grid, and it's quite large, it's not too bad, on which the density actually goes up by this delta to the 1 plus epsilon. And I won't have time, but it's pretty easy to see how from this dichotomy you can actually get theorem 2. You just assume that theorem 2 is false, which means this doesn't happen, which means this must happen. So then you actually have increased density on this arithmetic grid here. You define this to be your new set, this intersection, rescale it down so that the difference is 1. Because the increased density was in a grid of this shape, you know, this rescaled subset will again not contain, will not intersect this monomial curve, and you can iterate this process. But each time the density is increasing, and the grid is not getting too much smaller, right? And then you just play a game and balance it all out, and you get the bounds I was talking about. So what I should do now, I suppose, is sketch to you how you actually prove this dichotomy proposition. So let's see. So the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to suppose that this property R doesn't hold, and then conclude that then it must have structure. So I can make some assumptions here. So the first thing I'd like to say is that we can assume that B lives the worst sentence ever in my life. Anyway, so we assume that B lives away from the edges. What I mean by that, most of B is actually lives in the middle here, if this was an M script. Because I'm trying to show that one has structure, right? And so if B actually did concentrate in these areas here, then you would have structure. Well, actually with Q equal 1, right? So we can assume that B is mostly in the middle. Doesn't really matter. But it's just technical points. With this in mind, actually, I'm going to define S to be the set of points on this monomial curve where D actually doesn't go all the way up to M, but actually stops at some small constant times M. So in other words, this M is the points on the curve which are sort of there, right? It doesn't hit this. So one last thing I'd like to define is, and I'd like to define the balance function of the set B, which is denoted by F sub B, and that's just the characteristic function of B minus its average value over the cube on which it lives. Right? So this has the crucial property for us that it has mean value 0, hence the term balance function. So now one can... So why did I tell you this junk here? It's because that's sort of what you need to know in order to conclude the following, and it's quite simple. I'll just tell you what you get. So then it's easy to see then to define that balance function. So you can now quite easily see that if you sum over A's and B's and Z2 of the balance function at A, the balance function at B, and now the characteristic function of the set S at A minus B, that this is actually less than -1/4 delta DS. So where does this come about? Well, we're assuming that this monomial curve, dd squared, does not intersect the different set of B. So that means that this bilinear expression here with the characteristic function of B instead of the balance function is in fact 0. Right? So that fact, combined with the fact that B lives mostly in the middle, and the fact that we've actually reduced ourselves just to look at the beginning of this curve, allows us to conclude this. You can work it out, it's easy. But now this is a double sum, right? One of the sums is an inner product, the other sum is a convolution. So this tells us something if we write it on the Fourier transform side. So this tells us that if you look, so our dual space will be the torus. So if we look at the Fourier transform of the bound function squared, and the Fourier transform of the Cartesian function of our set S, then this must be bigger than this quantity I've written down here. Okay, so why is it nice writing it in this form? It's nice writing it in this form because what is this guy here? This guy here is nothing other than a vial sum. It's the sum from d equals 1 to m over 10 of e to the negative 2 pi I, and then what do we have? We've got d alpha 1 plus d squared alpha 2. Okay. It's a vial sum.
So do you really want to actually value this row of the Fourier transform?
Yes. Right, it's a negative here. It's just a vial sum. Right, this is the Fourier transform of an algebraic set, so we know that this should be the sum should be concentrated near rationals and small denominators, which means that actually this integral should be concentrated near rationals with small denominators, which is another way of saying arithmetic structure. So let's just So the property I'm going to use as a vial sum is simply that this sum contains, quite easy to see, this contains no cancellation if alpha is close to, if alpha 1 and alpha 2 are close to rationals with small denominators. And in fact, it's the only obstruction to cancellation, so let me actually just write down a standard estimate for sums of that type. Vial lemma, I guess. So let me define a set of arcs. So let NQ be all of the elements on the torus for which alpha j minus aj over q is less than some constant C naught over delta squared. Let's say MJ, that's what we should have here. That's what I mean by how close. So what's the result? The result is, if alpha is not on any of those arcs, for any Q small, and by small I mean this, then my sum is small. Of course, the trivial estimate would just be the size of S. Right? And the important thing here is that by picking my C naught sufficiently large, I can make this little c here as small as I like, which will be important to me because I want to ignore these arcs. I want to see that the main contribution to this integral is actually on the complement of this. So the so-called major arcs. So if alpha is a member of one of those arcs for some Q, well then you don't get much decay, but you do get up a little bit. You do get a little bit if the corresponding Q is large. So, and we actually use this. So you get a little bit of decay, 1 over the root Q. That's coming from estimates for a Gauss sum. Right? And in a higher dimensional case, when you look at if just a general K bigger than 2, one would have to use the Hoare's lemma to get q to the negative 1 over k here. Okay, so what happens now when you put that in? So if you put that in here, what do you get? Well, this tells you that when you're on the minor arc here, provided you pick C not large enough, that's just an error term. So it tells you that if you look at just all the major arcs, so that would be the sum from Q equals 1 to C naught delta to negative 2, of, and now we've got Q to negative 1/2 is the estimate we're getting for the vial sum. And now we're integrating over these collection of arcs with corresponding to rationals with denominator Q. So this is actually bigger than some small constant times delta B. Right, we have just divided both sides by the size of S. Right. B, of course, is delta times the size of Qn. Right, so very good. So of course, from this, we can conclude, there's got some in Q here, we can conclude that actually this integral over the collection of arcs MQ must be particularly large for at least one Q. Right? So just by a little bit of pigeonholing, we can actually see that there definitely exists one Q in this range, such that, and then I'll bring the delta squared size of QM over here. This guy must be bigger than, and what'd you get? Well, if you actually do it, you get this 1 plus epsilon. Delta to 1 plus epsilon. So this, and this implies, this statement here implies S. So I guess I have 5 minutes, I can actually probably do this. And this is where, and you see that, do I still have this statement? Yeah. So this implies S with this density increment sigma. So this is the concentration of the L2 mass of the Fourier transform. That should imply some additive structure. So what can we conclude from this? So it turns out we can conclude from this that, so let me define something. Let me define G to be the following grid. Let this be the grid that's negative L1 Q L2 Q squared, with L and QL, where QL is now actually equal to delta squared sigma M. So if I define this grid here, then what can I conclude? I can actually conclude that there exists an M such that the convolution of the balance function of B with the characteristic function of this grid evaluated at M is in fact large. In fact, it's bigger than some constant times delta sigma the size of G. Right, so this is sort of the heart of the matter, actually. Why does this, because from this we're actually done, right? Because from this we're done, because what is this convolution here? This convolution here is nothing other than the size of B intersection with, now what we're doing here is we're just translating G by M, so it's actually M minus G, into minus, because the balance function is assigned to be the characteristic function of B minus delta times the characteristic function of QM. Like so, right? So the fact that this is large means that this is also large. So, I guess I don't have enough time to finish, but it's not too hard to then actually see this implication here. But I think I'll stop there.